Welcome to Libre Lounge, a podcast about free software, free culture, and all the other interesting aspects of user freedom, with Christopher Lemmer-Weber and Serge Roklowski.
All right, I'm Serge. Welcome to Libre Lounge. Chris is on vacation while we're recording this. If you've been following their social media, they've been working on game engines and things related to Sprightly. If you're not familiar with Sprightly, it's a distributed MUD based on ActivityPub that Chris is working on. We'll let Chris describe that project when they get back. So I thought while Chris is on vacation that we would do something very different. Since Sprightly is a distributed MUD and MUDs usually have connections with fantasy role-playing games, I thought we would have a guest on to talk about tabletop fantasy role-playing games. So I brought in a friend of mine, Sean Hillman. Sean, say hi.
Hey, how's everybody doing?
I've known Sean about 15 years. He has run games for me as a GM. I know him as a game designer for a game called Twilight River that I played. For people that have played Dungeons & Dragons, he was one of the triad members of the Grand Duchy of Jeff, which is, we'll get into, it's the Mid-Atlantic region of the United States for Greyhawk in, I guess, the early 2000s. And let's see, what else, is that, how else do I know you, Sean?
Well, we played in Mark's game together.
That's true. We have a mutual friend that we've played in together. That's true.
And we hung at a lot of the same conventions in the same convention space for, oh gosh, probably about 5 years, I guess.
Yeah, it was a long time. It was a long time ago. It makes me feel old thinking about that.
Yeah.
So I want to get back to Grand Duchy of Jeff, and I think that's a nice sort of segue into some of the topics that we wanted to explore. So, you know, I want your input. So I'm going to explain my understanding of what happened, and then you can come in and say what really happened.
Okay.
So for people who aren't familiar, there's a game called Dungeons & Dragons. It's been going on in various incarnations since the 70s. It's a fantasy tabletop role-playing game. And there have been various incarnations of, I guess, what's called a living campaign, which is this worldwide game in which everybody can participate no matter where they are. They don't need to be connected to a particular person. And in the early 2000s, with the release of the third edition of Dungeons and Dragons, Wizards of the Coast created kind of a spin-off organization that ran a worldwide campaign called Living Greyhawk, and that they allowed each physical geographic region to be operated semi-independently. And Sean was one of the three leaders of the storyline and the rules for the Grand Duchy of Jeff, which was mapped roughly, so it was a region in the game, in the fantasy world, but it mapped roughly to the Mid-Atlantic region of the United States. Is that about right?
That's about right. It was Maryland, Delaware, D.C., and Virginia were the states involved, or city as well, cities involved in the Mid-Atlantic region. The Living Greyhawk ran, I believe, they initiated it in 2000 or 2001, and it ended in 2008. And in particular, I was a triad member from 2006 to 2008. We were sort of the second wave, second storyline is probably the best way to put it. There had been a five-year storyline, not unlike Babylon 5 or the original Star Trek. But once that 5 years was up, some new triad members came on, we ran a three-year story arc to culminate the campaign.
So for people who haven't played Dungeons & Dragons before, I think I'm gonna give this a crack and see if this resonates with you in terms of both the game and the history of the game. So the game, I think of it as, if you are familiar with the fantasy genre of fiction, so I think most people have at least heard of Lord of the Rings and those kind of settings, D&D, Dungeons & Dragons, allows you to play a character in one of those type of settings and be the hero of that story. And the history of it is that It started off as an offshoot of what was essentially a miniatures game. So people playing with, you know, war figurines and using them to simulate a battle, which was traditionally a historical battle, kind of morphed into playing fantasy battles. And then that shifted into a narrative focus. So instead of being focused on the battle, you are now focused on playing an individual character in that battle. And then my feeling is that over time, it was originally almost like playing a video game. Like you'd kind of jump into a character, it would have abilities, and if it died, you'd kind of roll a new one. But as time has progressed, people have become kind of attached to their characters, and the story elements have become more of a focus than just the strategic battle elements. Would you say that's true?
Right. The overarching life arc of a character has become more important than the in-camera, in-the-moment, tactical, or just even necessarily relational experiences of that character. And it's interesting that you brought up video games, because while it's at this point in our history, we can look back on video games and say, oh, well, D&D is a lot like playing a video game. In fact, a lot of the role-playing games, the CRPGs, are heavily influenced by Dungeons & Dragons. Now, I'm not an expert in Japanese RPGs, but I do know that D&D had a heavy influence in the creation of the Japanese RPGs. And someone can you know, someone else more knowledgeable can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's the case.
Yeah, and what's interesting, too, is that if you look at the history of role-playing games and the history of computer games, they actually start around the same time.
Right, yes.
So it's not that computer games were kind of based entirely on D&D. The two kind of grew up with each other in a parallel world where they kind of borrowed ideas from each other. And so you'd have ideas that might get introduced in one and then brought into the other with an interesting cross-pollination. In fact, if our listeners want to play some of these type of games, if you go back to our games episode, Chris mentioned a whole bunch of roguelikes. We've also touched on, and we're going to talk on in the future about interactive fiction. That's a whole genre of its own.
Yes.
So I think we're going to really stick here and talk about first about Dungeons and Dragons, but then about role-playing games and then how this connects to free culture, because that, of course, is an important part of our show. So just kind of finishing up the loop around being Greyhawk, traditionally, D&D is played with a group of people, usually friends, who kind of come together at a regular time, and your character is very much rooted with the game you play with your friends. I can't take my character and that maybe I play with you, Chris, Sean. I'm having Freudian slips here. That I play with you, Sean, and then go play it with, you know, Dave, right? The character and everything is set to you. And that was different with these living campaigns, and there were a number of them, Living Arcanus, Living Greyhawk, Living City, where the idea was that these would be standardized across the whole world, essentially.
Right, and actually Living City was the second edition version of Living Greyhawk. It took place in the city of Raven's Bluff in the Forgotten Realms, because the Forgotten Realms supplanted Greyhawk as the primary setting for Dungeons & Dragons in 2nd edition Dungeons & Dragons.
So you brought up a whole bunch of topics here, even without necessarily intending to.
Right.
I want to talk about each of them. So let's start with this, because you said 2nd edition.
Correct.
And I think one of the things that's a little bit interesting about D&D for me is that it's a game that has changed over the years and has these multiple rule variants. If you look at the rule set of the first Dungeons & Dragons, it's super simple. And if you look at Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, which was kind of one of the next iterations, it's also relatively simple and straightforward. And then 2nd edition, which is what I played, there was nothing simple about it. It was very complicated. Very spread out, had lots of quote unquote knobs to fiddle with, and was not actually that easy to play. And then we move on to 3rd edition and 3.5, which was a kind of a an update to 3 and so on. So I guess for people that aren't used to that idea of, you know, the rule set changing, can you talk about how, you know, the rules are different than the setting? Because you also brought up Forgotten Realms and Greyhawk. And for people that don't know, those two, what we would call settings, are in fact different. They're different fantasy worlds. They're not connected.
Correct. That's correct. So Greyhawk is what you might consider to be much more of a sword and sorcery type world, close to the early 20th century writings, that sort of thing. Whereas the Forgotten Realms is much more epic fantasy, much more Tolkien-like, if people understand the difference between the two of them. As far as editions go, pretty early on it was established, and this is true in Wargaming as well, miniature Wargaming, that rules change over time. The original D&D sort of morphed into what they called D&D Basic by 1979, and then there was quote-unquote Advanced D&D. And what the difference was, Advanced Dungeons & Dragons just had a lot more information in it. So, a lot more races or species.
I would just say it had a lot more knobs, right?
Yes,
so
right.
What you could really do is customize your character in different
correct.
Ways. So maybe you didn't want to play a human. Maybe you wanted to play an elf. And I want to get back to the story element in a
right.
bit. But what I think is interesting and important about these different races, and it's similar to the issues that we have in science fiction.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. The lens upon which we look at the world can be very difficult to take on a lot of these social issues directly. It can become overwhelming. And fantasy, whether it's science fiction or you know, quote unquote pure fantasy, is a way for us to explore these issues in more depth. So maybe we don't have white people and brown people. Maybe we have humans and elves, right? And in that way, we can fictionalize and better, handle these complex topics. And so by allowing for more customization of your character, it actually facilitates creating more story. It's not just a matter of creating more rules for battles, but also creating a more nuanced situation that motivates your character and motivates the what we would call the non-player characters, the NPCs, right? So motivates the story itself to move in a particular direction, to bring the players a more rich story experience.
Correct. That's correct. And D&D originally, or AD&D especially, allowed players to not just play, and I'm going to briefly go through this because not everyone's cognizant. When we talk about hero in the modern sense, most people think good guy. And anti-hero is a bad person who does good things. But hero in the classical sense is anyone who sort of rises to the occasion for their particular side of things. So, King, what's his face at Thermopylae? I can't remember his name. The Spartan king at Thermopylae, Leonidas, is a hero. But then so is Xerxes. Xerxes is a hero for the Persians. And so AD&D allowed you to play evil characters, if that was allowed in the Dungeon Master's setting. So you could play all sorts of morally gray or morally not gray individuals. It's interesting, too, not to get us too far off tangent, the exploration of our own social issues via things like different races, elves, dwarves, etc., half-orcs, orcs, has over time come under scrutiny as well, because over time, because of the unfortunate zeitgeist of D&D at times, has been very much a white colonial power fantasy. And that's changing.
Right, because of the European aesthetic. The European aesthetic of the depictions
correct.
Of medieval life and the romanticization of that aesthetic has absolutely bled into, well, and Tolkien was kind of unapologetic about it. He said, well, I'm a European. This is the background I have. He wasn't racist for the time, although probably by today's standards, it gets far more complex. That absolutely bled into both the aesthetic of the D&D game and then also the players of that game, right? Because it was the white suburban, it was the middle class white suburban kids who predominantly played D&D and who we think of today as the, you know, the players. And, you know, if you were, you know, it was also an expensive hobby, because you had to buy a bunch of things, and also to have the free time to play that kind of game was very connected with all these issues. The thing I wanted to touch upon was that, you know, this idea of who is a hero and is really connected with the Joseph Campbell idea of the hero's journey. And I think that's when you, you know, arising to action and having a change and whatever that change is. In fact, well, you know, when we see a story on TV and there's a change, a bad, you know, a kind of a sloppy story is one in which external forces change, but a good one is where the character goes through some kind of transformation. And I would say that that's also the case with Dungeons and Dragons, where if you're, you know, if you've got a good storyline, it's not just that the situation changes, it's also that your characters and the way that the players play those characters will also transform.
Correct. And that was built into the game in a lot of ways. Dungeons and Dragons, for those who are not aware, is what they call a class level, or class and level based. So you take on a profession, fighter, thief, mage, and then you progress in level. And the levels show your progression. You know, at first level, you're, you know, you've just started out your journeyman, but by 20th level, which was a typical end spot, by 20th level, you're essentially almost as powerful, you're as powerful as any mortal could be. And you're almost, you're more powerful than certain demigods at that point. So that is, so there was change over time built in, as well as rules eventually for building your own strongholds, for becoming a king or a, you know, a powerful archmage, that sort of thing. All designed to integrate story and rules together.
I want to touch on something you said, then I want to rewind this back to some other topics.
Okay.
You know, you did touch on the idea of progression, right? And so level progression is kind of how it's done in D&D. And not all systems have level progression. And that can be interesting too, from the perspective of, are you playing this just to get more powerful? Or are you playing this to tell a story and to be interesting? And there are advantages and disadvantages to both. And I think that's an interesting discussion maybe for another time.
Absolutely.
I want to talk a little bit about, not necessarily the history of D&D in terms of, okay, well, this guy put out this edition in this year. But if you look at D&D, it's heavily influenced, as we talked about a little bit, by Tolkien, right? By Lord of the Rings, essentially.
Right.
And in fact, the Tolkien estate sued TSR, at the, you know, who was at the time the rights holders for D&D.
Correct.
And then they had to change some of the names of the races and change some of the depictions of those races based on their similarity to the Tolkien ideas.
Correct, that's right.
Even though Tolkien himself took so much of his inspiration from mythology.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. Specifically you're talking about Hobbit and I believe the tall elves.
Dwarf.
And dwarf and things like that. Hobbit, you know, originally they were called hobbits, but then they were termed halflings, which was a compromise, I believe, between TSR and the Tolkien estate. Even though halfling is also mentioned in the book, it was, you know, well, I guess
it was generic enough that it didn't ring the same alarm bell
as exactly.
The Tolkien's. But let's move on off the detail a little bit and talk about. So we talked a little bit about the aesthetic of D&D, and the aesthetic of D&D is very much a medieval aesthetic. It's kind of medieval life plus magic.
Correct. Right? Correct.
It's the medieval life that is in mythology rather than real life. Only about half of our listeners are American, but for people who've been to a Renaissance fair, right?
Right.
It's like, well, you know, this is all historically accurate, and you can get your historically accurate fried ice cream and, you know, fairy wings and all that. And that's also, I would say, not just an aesthetic of European ideas, but also kind of an American aesthetic.
Yes.
Of the medieval life. It's a very American idea.
Right. It's an Americanized version of almost specifically, not entirely, almost specifically, Anglo-Saxon, Anglo-Norman medieval life. And I think, I hope, at least some of the non-Americans will appreciate that, because it's not just medieval Europe in life, because the game doesn't, I mean, it touches on other cultures like Italy, you know, Italian culture and Spanish and Portuguese culture, and Vikings are romanticized, but it really doesn't do a good job of talking about Norse culture from that time. And frankly, it doesn't really do a great job of talking about Welsh and Scottish and Irish cultures at that time. It really kind of is focused on that narrow part of England and the northern parts of France that that we're most influenced by in our culture.
Yeah, in the American zeitgeist, yes. of ideal.
Absolutely.
So let's break completely here and talk about this idea of rules, right? So we've talked about settings. Let's talk about rules.
I love rules.
So I mentioned that D&D has gone through these iterations, and bring this back to the fact that this is a free, you know, user freedom podcast, mm-hmm. and a free culture podcast. There was a big change in 3.0, whereas tradition, you know, before then, the rules were copyright, you know, TSR, or at some point became Wizards of the Coast, which is an arm of
Hasbro now.
Hasbro, yeah. Sorry, I couldn't think of the name. Yeah, so it's basically owned by Hasbro under the name Wizards of the Coast, and they bought it from a small company called TSR.
Correct.
But at 3.0, they changed the rules to a new license, similar to a software license, called the Open Gaming License.
Right.
And that opened up so many possibilities for other people to add stories and also new rules on top of. And I know that was something that you were very involved in, so maybe you can talk about that.
Sure. The OGL is important in a lot of ways. And I think probably we don't necessarily understand all the... we still don't understand all the intricacies of using the Open Gaming License. But in essence, they created 3rd edition, and then they said, here is a system reference document. Anything that's in this SRD, you can use to create your own games using this system. And there were certain rules attached to it. And it's changed over, as most things, it's changed over time, but we won't get into that at the moment. So what you saw, and at the same time that the RPG industry was entering two phases, one of them, well, it had been in this phase for a little bit, but the indie gaming movement was ongoing. The industry was in a down slump because, whether we like it or not, as D&D goes, so does the RPG industry. When it's popular and making money, the rest of the industry is sort of picked up by that. When it's in a down phase, in a trough, people don't play as many other RPGs. So the two are connected. But what really happened with the OGL, whether expected or not, there was a lot of content created by content creators. And there was a focus on setting and creating specific pieces of content without worrying about having to design a system to run them. There are many hundreds, maybe even thousands by now, of role-playing games. But so the OGL allowed a user like me to take a familiar system, that is Dungeons & Dragons, basic framework, and turn it into my own game, you know, Sean's World, which could be fantasy, could be science fiction, could be urban fantasy. And so that not only inspired a lot of creators and a lot of creations, it also jumped the industry up for a short time. So there was a lot of money to be had, at least over a short period of time.
And that's interesting from a number of different perspectives. So as you say, you know, well, so what people may not know is that you could kind of always put out setting. There were books on settings.
Yes.
So, you know, you could say, well, okay, I'm going to create my own world. I could make, you know, my own Greyhawk. But what you couldn't do was say, oh, and by the way, in my Greyhawk world, these are some new rules, unless you were licensed by the game company.
Correct.
Right. So you had to make an agreement that, like, yes, I'm, you could make your own fictional world, and you could say, and you can set this world in D&D, but you couldn't modify the D&D rules themselves. And with the OGL, you could say, well, okay, well, this just kind of fits nicely into this existing system, and without having to go to Wizards of the Coast and get permission directly. As long as your system was licensed in a compatible way to the OGL, you could just go ahead and do that.
Correct.
Which created a ton of new games that might have, as you said, been done in their own setting, their own rule set, but now they were all kind of fitting together into this Roll D20 system.
Correct.
That was kind of at the core of D&D and the OGL was kind of almost synonymous with this D20, which was just a way of unifying a whole bunch of complicated rules into a much more streamlined, simple rule set.
Right. It's D20 was branding, very much branding. It's like, hey, this is a D20 thing. And that, you know, that signals to the person, oh, hey, this must be compatible with D20, or with the OGL. And the two interesting things happen, cause I don't know the date of the second one, in the, that really unleashed the creativity. Because prior to the OGL, you were either a guy, and mostly a guy, not always, but you were as a person in your basement printing stuff out or going to Kinko's and printing stuff out and selling your game sort of either by mail order or at conventions. So two things happen. One, the OGL comes out. Now, there were a lot of other systems, not just D&D, that use the Open Gaming License or similar licensing. So that opened up the wider for creative people. But also, and I know not everybody loves Adobe, and I understand that, but the standardization of the PDF was then allowed people like me to sell electronic versions of a game without having to go through a printer. That was huge. That was huge. And the two of those together, the open license and the PDF, suddenly it's opened up a huge chasm full of people who are making their own content.
That's interesting. Because I want to talk about some of the other game systems that are out there, some of the other freely licensed game systems.
Right.
And also, you know, how all this content gets created. So let's take a quick break.
Okay.
And then we'll come back and we'll talk about that.
Sounds great.
During these breaks, we like to highlight projects that are important and or overlooked. I want to use this break to highlight Freedom Defined. It's a website that describes the ideals of Freeworks in a way that's neutral to whether it's related to hardware, software, or art. In particular, there's a great discussion there about the OGL and some of the more controversial terms of the license. So I welcome you to check it out. All right, and we're back with Sean Hillman talking about role-playing games. And I think now we can talk a little bit about, now that we've gotten through what is this stuff, we can talk about the free culture aspect.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Before we left for break, we were talking about how there was this license called the Open Gaming License and how it allowed content creators to basically make free worlds and rule extensions on top of Dungeons and Dragons. And I think what's interesting here is that we made this distinction. We said, well, you could always have other settings, other, you know, imaginary worlds, but you couldn't change the rules. And now with the OGL, you could do both the settings and the rules.
Correct. Right. Right.
And so at some point, Wizards of the Coast retired Dungeons and Dragons, and they made a new game, Dungeons and Dragons 4. And around that time, a new game kind of came about called Pathfinder, which was essentially Dungeons and Dragons 3.5 with a few tweaks and changes and a whole new setting. Can you talk about that a little?
Sure. Colloquially, it's known as 3.75, or D&D 3.75. So Pathfinder, again, the 3.5 player base was very passionate about their game. And we wanted 3.75. We wanted a further refinement of the system that we had. Because it had only been roughly 7 years since third edition came out. And second edition was around for 10 years. So nobody really thought it was time for a change. And, but Wizards of the Coast had a different opinion, obviously. And fourth edition is very much different in a lot of ways than
it was a radical edition. It was a radical departure.
It's a radical departure. It really is.
Not just in terms of tweaking, you know, how much damage an arrow gives you, but a radical departure in play style and gaming. And people have done tons and tons of write-ups and podcasts and YouTube videos about this. So we don't need to get into the details. But we will say, I can say that as a player, I was far less drawn to 4.0 from a story character perspective than I was to the 3.0 and 3.5. And even the systems before that, even 2.0.
Right. Yeah. Agreed. And so the people at Paizo had
the said, company well, you that know makes, what? The company that made Pathfinder.
Yes, yes. The company that makes Pathfinder. They had been involved making Dragon magazines up to that point, I think, or Dungeon magazines to that point. And the people at Paizo said, well, we're not interested in that. We have the OGL. We have the 3.5 SRD. We're going to make Pathfinder.
And in addition, my understanding was that D&D 4 was not freely licensed. It was not under the OGL.
Correct. 4.0
is not. So they could not even have decided. So if they had wanted to continue working in the same business model, they couldn't have done that without working directly with Wizards of the Coast, Hasbro.
Correct. And I think that was done on purpose because the OGL had spawned. That was Pandora's box, or the genie. Genie was out of the bottle. So you can't put the genie back in the bottle. What you can do is you can say, okay, well, you can have your genie, but we have our own other genie over here in a bottle, and we'll play with this over here.
To put it another way, what had happened was that there was so much new material, so many new games, and so much stuff coming out for Dungeons and Dragons or for the D20 system that was licensed under the OGL, that we can speculate that this was taking a chunk of market share from Wizards of the Coast, at least in their own minds.
Correct.
Which inspired them, let's say, to create a new system that would not be freely licensed. So they kind of went back and said, you know what, this isn't working for us. And whereas Paizo, and I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that right, decided to say, you know what, actually, we're going to stick with the freely licensed content. We're going to build upon it, just like the license says we can. So they basically, in the parlance of the free software community, they forked it. They said, we're going to continue doing this. And they forked it, and they created their own setting in the same way that Wizards of the Coast had Forgotten Realms and had Greyhawk. They said, well, we'll make our own setting. And I think you know the name of that setting. I don't recall it off the top of my head.
It is called Galarian.
So they had Galarian, and they continued to make books and materials and miniatures and supplements and tons and rule books and tons of material for Pathfinder. In fact, they still do today make material for Pathfinder.
Yes, yes, they do.
And I think what's interesting here is that, as you say, you know, the genie was let out of the bottle, not just in terms of Pathfinder, but also in terms of making the public aware that there were other freely licensed games.
Correct. Right.
And the one that I know of that Chris has mentioned to me is Fate, but you also, which is kind of a universal system.
Very much,
like
yes.
There's a proprietary version, I guess, would be GURPS, and then Fate is kind of like GURPS in that way.
Oh, but even more generic than GURPS,
which is, by the way, GURPS standing for the generic universal role playing game.
So, yeah.
Even more generic than the generic universal. Yes.
Very much so. Fate actually comes from Fudge, which is. Sort of its ancestor, but yeah, the idea behind Fate and Fudge is to pull out all the unnecessary detail and allow players to more focus more. I dare use the word story, and we'll get into that at some point, but kind of focus on their characters as people and their actions more than their capabilities.
So their motivation rather than, okay, well, if I choose this weapon, it's going to have this damage at this distance, they can say, well, actually, what is the motivation of my character? Why am I doing this? And I right. think that's the... And look, there's room for both, but for certain types of people like one and certain types of people like another, and a lot of people like myself like a mix of both, right? But there's definitely a need for some story, at least in my role-playing.
Correct, right. And so Fate and Fudge and systems like that sort of get out of the way of the role-playing. They're not, you know, it's not as front and center as it is in Dungeons & Dragons, for instance.
That makes sense. So the other one you'd mentioned is a system I'd never heard of called Powered by the Apocalypse. And so I looked it up, and it's a CC, so Creative Commons attribution only. So right. very freely licensed, even more freely licensed than OGL is.
Yep, absolutely.
Can you tell me a little bit about that system?
Well, Vincent Baker and the creator was another name in when it comes to indie RPGs. It's very much a big name in that. And so Vincent created Apocalypse World, which uses a system, and it's very, very sort of in-your-face kind of game. But as you said, he allowed the Powered by the Apocalypse engine to be freely used on a Creative Commons, and that has spawned a number of games out of that. Dungeon World probably being the most famous of those games.
So yeah, I mean, it wasn't so specifically because there are also systems that are Creative Commons and they're not free, right? So they have non-commercial distribution restrictions, so you can't make any money, you can't even sell your own work, or they have non-derivatives, so you can't build upon them. And in my mind, you know, non-derivatives and non-commercial are essentially the same as proprietary, especially for the purposes of a gain system where the whole idea is to be able to build upon it. So you know, for me, the idea of an attribution only game system is very attractive, and as is also OGL. I think that's interesting. I want to stick a little bit to the OGL stuff, mainly because it's what I know. I know Chris knows Fate much better,
right?
But I want to talk a little bit about this explosion, or what you call the Pandora's box or the genie. But I would just say, you know, an explosion of content, an explosion of people being creative and trying things. And you also, at least I saw an explosion of companies
yes.
jumping on this and using it to make money and to make new stories and new worlds and new ways for players to, you know, to connect with this fantasy genre, whether it was, you know, high fantasy, medieval fantasy or other systems. It really seemed to just go in a million directions. So maybe you can talk about that.
Well, not just high fantasy, or not just fantasy, but, cultural, there was also an important cultural explosion, although that has seemed to come later. Where, oh, I don't have to make this about European fantasy. I can do Japanese, or I can do Chinese, or I can do African, which has been a big explosion of late, telling stories from different points of view, not just appropriated culture, but individuals from that culture now don't have as many barriers as they once did. So now we're getting completely different stories. But there are a lot of success stories that come out of the OGL. People who worked for, who may have been designers for Dungeons & Dragons, then go on to create their own games. Monty Cook is a great example of that. There's more than just an explosion of D&D content or D&D adjacent content. The OGL, it infects people's minds. Before, if you're creating it, I know for me specifically, you know, oh, I'm creating my system and I don't necessarily want anybody to play with my system because that's, you know, that's not how it's done. But then suddenly we think, well, wait a minute. People see that the system is available for free to use. for their world. Suddenly, that breaks that mold of, I have to hold on to it in order for it to be successful. And we found that actually when you release something into the wild free for people to use, you actually become much more wildly successful, because people are see what you've done, they take what you've done, and they want to go back to you and say, look what I've done. And it created this great culture, this mix of this chaos of game design, that, you know, infected by the indie movement, I think, has created a lot of success stories.
Well, and when you think about the time this was the very late 90s, early 2000s, and you were seeing freely licensed games in the early mid 90s on Usenet, people were talking about some of these systems.
Sure.
But what OGL did was it kind of popularized this idea and brought it to the gaming masses. It kind of like how the open source movement brought, you know, free software ideas of licensing to the greater community.
Right.
Where we had had these ideas for a long time, but they popularized it. And that led to more accessibility to try new things out, and which is exactly what you're talking about, what you're seeing.
Right.
I want to kind of go back to D&D a little bit.
Sure.
And because I think there's some big lessons to be learned. So first of all, as we said, when they put out fourth edition, wasn't it quite their fourth edition of their rule set, because there were these intermediate versions. But
right.
You know, when they put out that edition, they went back to the proprietary model. They tried to go proprietary after having been free. I think both because of the licensing and because the system was so bad, it didn't work out.
Right.
You know, yes, gaming was, you know, yes, it might have made money, but the hardcore gamers kind of turned their back on D&D. And I think almost for the first time in a big way, because yes, there were some people that didn't like third edition, but those people were a minority. Most people saw third edition, I think, as a necessary streamlining of what had become a very complicated system. Whereas fourth edition just didn't have the rule aesthetic, and I don't know what else you'd call it. It didn't have the rule aesthetic of a Dungeons and Dragons.
Yep.
And when they moved to fifth edition, I actually think of fifth edition as being fourth edition. It feels very much like you take Pathfinder almost and then go, okay, well, let's kind of clean that up even more.
Well, I wouldn't even necessarily characterize it as that, because Pathfinder sort of has found its footing in more complication.
Mm.
So fifth edition is related to Pathfinder in the sense that it's a reaction, I think, to Pathfinder, because more complication. And with Pathfinder 2, there's even more complication. And I'm not putting down complication in my games. I love complicated. But Pathfinder took the path, not no pun intended, of more complication. And D&D 4th Edition was, to a certain extent, was like that. I think that they thought they were making it less complicated, but it was definitely, I think, more complicated. And 3rd Edition and 3.5 had also become more overcomplicated. And that's why we wanted a 3.75.
But and I think the idea of fifth edition, because what I wanted to get to is, yes, it was a simpler system, but it was also free again. It was now once again under the OGL.
Yes.
And I think that's kind of an interesting story from a free culture perspective of a company that went free, pulled away, and then said, okay, well, we're gonna go back. And people are, I think, a little bit skeptical of what the future of free, you know, OGL content is under Wizards of the Coast. But the beauty of a free license is that you don't really have to have confidence in the publisher, right?
Right, right.
And that's what Pathfinder showed was, you know, I think the idea was, and the term we use is open washing, right? Which
yep.
is, okay, well, it's free, but it's not really free. And well, one day we'll kind of, we'll give you a taste and then we'll pull it back. And what Wizards
right.
of the Coast learned was, oh, that actually doesn't work, because
oh.
if people like what you've put out and then you get rid of it, they'll just keep using it. And in fact, with freely licensed content, now they can just build upon that.
Correct. Yes. Right.
So So that was the beauty here, and you're kind of seeing that again with 5th edition, a little bit slower. But you are seeing third parties come and start to make 5th edition content. Again, at least my experience is it's not quite the same renaissance as it was for 3 and 3.5, but I'm seeing it. Are you seeing that as well?
Well, yes. And I think two reasons, real quick, why that's the case is that the branding is different. So if I put out a 5e setting, it's the 5e isn't the such a high level isn't a brand as much as D20 was. 5e is a very casual brand. It's like it's not like, oh, this is my favorite IPA. It's like, yeah, you know, it's an IPA. You know, that's sort of different. And the second thing is that Wizards of the Coast has opened the DMs Guild, which allows people to create content with their content and make money off of it. Now, people will argue that you're not making a lot of money, and Wizards of the Coast is making a lot of money off your work. Okay, that's true. But the fact is that I can go, and I have made a adventure for the Forgotten Realms that no one said I couldn't make. No one stopped me because within the parameters of the content creation, I was able to use their world, which I think is an interesting, I think holds a lot of interesting, for the future. I think that we're going to see how the DM Guild evolves when 6th edition gets here.
Yeah, that will be interesting. So let's talk a little bit about, something you've touched upon a couple times here, which is that, so we've seen these explosions in content creation, but the general situation around the gaming industry has changed a lot in terms of sale and distribution, and that has that has also had an effect on, I would say, both a positive and negative effect on the way content is created and distributed.
Correct.
So, back in the 70s, especially in the 80s and 90s, you know, you had gaming stores, kind of like comic book shops, and sometimes they were both comic book shops and gaming stores,
right.
where people would, and I'm going to self-describe here, geeks and nerds would put out books, and they might even have a few tables where people could play games, and it would be a communal space with a commercial element.
Correct.
Those stores have largely, not entirely, but have largely gone away.
Yeah.
Due to just, well, in proportion generally to independent bookstores going away. Rent is expensive.
It is.
The kind of the kind of material that these guys would carry, and I say guys, it could be women, but they were often owned by men, these gaming stores, would be slow moving, and there'd be a lot of people who would go and frankly not buy anything. And so it was a very hard business to maintain. And so, you know, online retailers have eaten their lunch because they don't need to keep, you know, they don't need to have pretty displays. They don't need to, they can deal with the long tail of material without having to use up valuable real estate in their store.
Correct. Right.
And so most gaming stores are gone. And we can talk, I don't think we want to do that here, about the rise of gaming cafes, because I think that's a fascinating change. But online digital distribution has kind of exploded.
Yes, it has.
And
very much so.
There's more money in D&D today, and I'm specifically meaning Dungeons & Dragons. There's more money in Dungeons & Dragons today than there has even in the 80s, when it was kind of at its cultural height.
Correct.
And that's amazing to me, right? So when I think about, you know, the height of D&D, I think about, you know, the 80s, I think about Stranger Things, you know, the TV show Stranger Things, and I think about kids playing in their basement. But no, there's actually more people playing D&D today, of more different age groups, and there's more sales of D&D material than there ever has been.
Correct. Yes.
But it's not as culturally visible as it was back then. And because the online retailer has taken over, you don't see it in stores with the same prominence that you would have in a gaming store environment in the past.
Right. Ironically, of course, if we're talking specifically about D&D, and I suspect other companies will follow. That's sort of reversing in the last year. Everything you said is more or less is how I see it as well. But Target specifically, I know, carries D&D stuff now.
And Barnes & Noble's as well.
Yes, bookstores have carried it for a while, and where they used to have huge sections, there are smaller sections now. But yeah, the Target is now carrying the D&D stuff, which, you know, you used to be able to buy a Player's Handbook at Toys R Us back in the 80s and early 90s. But then they sort of stopped carrying that. And now that's sort of creeping back into the consumer zeitgeist. And it's starting to get back into in front of consumers, which is interesting to me.
That is interesting. So before we wrap up, there's something really important, and I wanted to make sure that we had enough time to talk about it.
Sure.
So in the first half of this episode, we talked about how the aesthetic of fantasy was tied into the aesthetic of Tolkien. And the aesthetic of Tolkien was very much the European idea of medieval life.
Right.
And with the explosion of content with the OGL, you're seeing people of different cultures explore those cultures in a fantasy realm or a fantasy setting in a way that's not so stereotypical or pure cultural appropriation, so that it's correct. It's actually a nuanced and interesting, and also I would say also not fetishized in the same way that we often see Eastern cultures fetishized in Western media.
That's a perfect way to put it. Yep.
And this ties very much into something that you've been doing, and I think deserves some attention, which is that you are putting out an e-zine about diversity in role-playing game.
Right. Earlier this year, Kickstarter, their games guy, decided they want to do fanzines for February. I focus on fanzines in February. Old school.
So zines are like kind of mini magazines.
Yeah.
They were popular in like the 70s.
Yes.
And the, like and the 80s. Yeah.
The Trek people, the role-playing people, the Star Wars people, everyone was doing their, you know, the horror people. That was big. You know, everyone was doing their own fanzine. So a bunch of people decided to go ahead and, you know, take up on that. And I was like, well, what am I going to do? Because, you know, the people are going to do games. And I'm like, okay. But I always loved Dragon Magazine. If you've never read Dragon Magazine, you're all interested in gaming culture and D&D culture. Pick up some old issues. But the thing I loved about old OG Dragon Magazine is that it didn't just have D&D stuff. It had stuff from all over. And it was stories. It was characters. It was art.
Yeah, it was inspiration for people who were making fantasy role-playing games.
Yes, it was. And so I'd had a project that I'd had on the back burner for some time because I've been aware that even though people of color and women and non-binary folks and people...
So underrepresented minorities.
Underrepresented people in general had been playing D&D for years. The fact is that they were still invisible. I mean, even the very popular Critical Role, which I highly recommend, it's entertaining. I think they do a great job. It's still not as representative as of the entire gaming zeitgeist as it could be. And I'm not criticizing Matt Mercer and his folks. Not at all. I think Matt Mercer's been great for inclusivity and diversity in D&D. But anyway, Dirge, the diversity in role-playing game experiences, was my sort of idea that I had no idea what I was going to do with it, honestly. It was like, I know I want to do a thing, and I want to, you know, put it in front of people who don't look like me, who don't love like me, who don't, act like me. And then when the fanzine thing came up, like, you know what, I'm going to do Dirge scene, and I'm going to open it up exclusively to people, content creators from underrepresented groups. The only words of mine that are in there could be the editorial. Everything else is created by women and some people of color and people who, you know, are non-binary. So it was really, I'm really passionate about it. I'm very happy it succeeded.
Yeah, I mean, what's I think what we're seeing here, and for listeners who might be new and will have not heard our really early episode about hacker culture, is that many people who feel excluded kind of go into fantasy and right. as an escape. And what we're seeing now is that people who may not even have been exposed to fantasy role-playing games are coming into it and finding a means of telling their stories through these medium. That's very different, actually, than the exclusion that many of us white suburban geeks experienced. And
right.
you know, the other one that I'm thinking about is Matt Baume's series where he has drag queens playing D&D, and that's their podcast. Just yeah. drag queens playing D&D.
Right. And, that's fantastic.
You know, and what you're doing here, which is highlighting the work of people who are traditionally underrepresented in gaming, is also really important. I will say I wish it was free culture. I wish the zine was freely licensed, but I still think that despite that, it's worth talking about and thinking about. And I know that you're going to put that out soon, and you're also simultaneously working on another zine to help bring in the youth.
Yes. And ARM zine, the Apprentice Role-Playing Manual, ties into Durzine in the sense that I've stripped out all the cultural, I don't know if we can say, cross, I don't know if we can curse on the podcast.
You can. I don't like, Chris actually curses more than I do. I would prefer not, but you can if you need to.
I strip out all
the nonsense?
All bullcrap. Okay. Yeah, all the nonsense. Because it's not necessary. And I'm stripping out a lot of the unnecessary traditions, which are just, it's just a barrier to entry. So kids or non-kids, adults, will be able to sit down with Armzine, roll, you know, make some rolls, create characters, and they're not bound by any kind of tradition. They can just sit down for 2 hours and have fun. And they can sit down 2 hours tomorrow and have different kinds of fun. And that's the goal of Armzine.
That's really interesting. So, since we've been talking for a while and probably need to start wrapping up, in terms, and I know you've listened to a few of our shows, mm-hmm. Is there anything that you want to touch on? Oh, actually, there was, that you wanted to touch on some ideas of funding models that we could have, or that freely licensed content creators could have to keep themselves going, even when their work is available.
Right. And real quick, Armzine will be, I'm not sure which exactly license I'm going to use, but even though the magazine will cost you something to buy if you want it, the system itself that I'm going to create with Armzine will actually be free.
Oh, wow. We should talk about that offline. I have some opinions, and I bet Chris, when they get back from vacation, will as well.
Okay, great. Yeah, absolutely. But that will be free. People will be able to create any game they want with Armzine. So
I have some thoughts about funding models for content creators.
Sure.
And this comes out of the work that I did when I was working for Question Copyright. And Chris and I did a show on free culture, and we did a two-parter on funding of free software. And I think funding of free software and funding of free culture are distinct. And I think not only the model's different, but the ideas behind them are different.
Right.
So the first thing I would say is that although I don't love the platform, the specific platform, I think the model of ongoing donations to creators that you like is good. And you know, patrons, and I don't like the fact that Patreon has kind of stolen the idea of patrons, but I think the idea of patrons is a good one.
Right.
And I think is a good model. And in fact, and I know you used Kickstarter for both Durzine and Armzine, and I would actually love to see an ongoing funding model where I could just say, well, I like the work that you're doing. I'm just going to keep giving you, and I actually know that you have a Patreon, but you know, to kind of focus that money and that energy to those ongoing efforts rather than a one-off efforts.
Sure. Yes, agreed.
That's the first one. The second one is that there's nothing stopping you from putting out this stuff in digital or, well, first of all, just in digital form. So you could say, well, download it and you know, pay what you want. That's the kind of the humble bundle model, is pay what you want.
Right.
And, you know, suggest a cost. And, you know, say, well, you know, I would really like it if you paid $5 for this.
Right.
And you don't have to require. In fact, you could even say, well, this is going to cost you $5 if you download it from me. I don't think that's a great model because it just kind of encourages people to not. But right. You can certainly do that.
Yeah.
You can also sell physical copies. And I actually think that that's a worthwhile thing, even though I'm not a big fan of adding a lot of junk to the world.
Right.
I think that people do connect with physical materials in a way that they don't with digital materials.
That's absolutely true.
And
I totally agree
so,
with that.
You know, if you're going to put out a something physical, though, it should be beautiful. So it shouldn't just be like, oh, I've just, you know, I went to my local copy shop and printed out a bunch of black and white copies, which I stapled together. If it's
right.
You know, if it's beautiful and glossy, and if people think it's going to last or look good on their shelf, they're going to pay for it.
Sure, they will. Absolutely.
Yep. And I think they'll pay for other things like, you know, T-shirts. You know, talking about the Grand Duchy of Jeff, I remember a Battle Interactive where people were selling T-shirts for the Battle Interactive.
Yes.
And it says, I survived I forget the name of the battle now, but it was...
I think it was Gorna.
Was that it?
I think it was Gorna.
Okay.
I want to say
yes, it was
Gorna.
The Battle of Gorna. Yes.
Yeah.
And I didn't even participate in that battle, and I had a T-shirt, because I
right.
thought it was that awesome.
It is awesome.
And so you could sell T-shirts. You can sell stuffed animals. You can sell material related. And the other thing is, if you're afraid that somebody's going to take your work and, let's say, make their own book, first of all, you can say on your website, hey, this is an unofficial copy. Please don't buy this.
Right.
And then you can also use trademark, which is separate from copyright. So you can
yes.
trademark right. a symbol and say, well, this is how you know it's from me or licensed from me.
Right.
And please buy the ones that have my trademark. And people cannot legally put your trademark on their unofficial works. Now,
right.
that also means that they can make their own and they can have their own trademark, but your trademark is yours and no one can make, and they also can't make a trademark that looks similar, because that's the whole idea of trademark.
Yes, right, exactly.
So I think that, you know, those are the ways that you can do this. And in fact, I think that this actually, you know, that for most people, they're not going to notice any difference. Meaning that they're not going to see like, oh, my sales are lower than they would have been. If anything, the fact that they're making their work available is going to excite their audience and encourage people to give them money.
I can agree with that to a certain degree. Because we've talked about that, you know, the OGL, free license to a system, created a boon in the industry. It didn't crush the industry, it created a boon. And a creative and financial boom. What I always fight against, or what I always struggle with, is the idea that yes, I want my stuff to be accessible to people. So for me, it's not as big a deal if I'm selling for $3 versus $5. I don't sell cheap because I'm not confident in what I've made. I sell cheap because I want people to buy it and be accessible. At the same time, however, I feel, and nobody hate me, I've never been a union guy, but I do feel a certain degree of camaraderie and responsibility to the other people in this industry. We're all fighting to get paid what we're worth, whether as freelancers or as content creators. And so it's always that sort of struggle between I'm worth this level, and we don't even have to put it in terms of money, because I know that makes some people uncomfortable, but I'm worth this much money or whatever, however you're going to evaluate it, because of what I've done. Art is, I think, very important to human existence. But kind of to get us back to what we were talking about, I think the how those models that you were talking about work best is community and creating a strong community. If you create a strong community, if you have 100 people buying a game for $5, you're going to get $500. If you have 5,000 people buying a game for $2, you've made $10,000. And I think it's volume of community. The bigger the community, the more successful we'll be. And I think that's how we're going to be able to be successful as content creators, by creating large communities.
Well, and I think there's two other parts to this, which is that one of the things that has bugged me as a free culture activist is that the proprietary world has learned our tricks, right? Learned how we connect with audience and kind of exploited that. And so they're doing exactly what we do, but without all the freedom. So for me, I think the important part that we need to do is specifically and explicitly say the freedom here is the feature, right? If you look at software, people will say, and it's open source, right? And I don't love the term open source. I'm a free software guy, but you know, that's the label, right? It's open source is that's a feature. And if you're a consumer, you might look for that as a reason to spend money on a company, right? So, I don't have to buy it, but it's open source, so I'm going to get support from that company. Correct. And the problem I think that free culture has had, and this includes free gaming, is that free culture activists and free culture creators have not been as open and as loud about, hey, this is free culture. And I want you to know that this is a feature of my stuff, and you should be looking for this. And if when you don't see it, you should be asking why. And then once that happens, we can do some really interesting things. So, for example, you know, you mentioned accessibility in terms of economics, right? So, if something is $5, and say $5 instead of $10, maybe at $10, it's out of the hands of certain people.
But
you could say, okay, well, how about if we have a sale in which you pay $20, but by doing that, you are going to fund another person getting a copy of this for nothing.
Sure. You see that actually people on Twitch, I'm not shilling for Twitch.
Yeah, but...
You have the option that people can gift subscribers.
Mm-hmm.
And they do it all the time for channels. That's how a lot of these channels are growing. I'm finding out is that you have this person who has $100 that they can spend, who will give out 20 subscriptions for free to other people.
Yeah. And I think that we're, you know, going back to the Patreon model and the Twitch model, you know, what we're seeing are ongoing support is important for content creators.
Yes.
You know, they can't just always get it because of a particular thing. They need that ongoing support so that they can keep doing what they're doing. And we need to find funding models that work with that, which also might mean that you would have, and we're not seeing this quite yet, but content creators banding together and saying, well, okay, well, we're a publisher, right?
Right.
And it's kind of like the CSA model for farm stuff. Right. So I can pay for a subscription and I get all the fruits and vegetables for that year. Right. You might see that with certain content creators where they're going to say, well, we'll send you whatever we make for this year. And you're going to pay for us to be fed while we're doing it. And you won't know exactly what's going to come out of this. But whatever comes out, you'll get a copy of. So that's all possible. And that's still possible with free culture. And I think free culture is part of this because, as you've said, this is part of the human experience is building on other people's work.
Oh yeah, I totally agree with that. There's something I'm involved with, and I'm almost finished to design the game for this. Adam he goes by Adam R. Kitch on Twitter, but RPG Kitchen, essentially how RPG Kitchen works, and I'll do this real quick, is that they accept games from designers, and they have tiers in their Patreon, and you sign up for a tier in your Patreon, and like if you sign up for $3, you get all the games that are at the $3 tier, and half the money goes to feed people, goes directly to hunger. So there are things that are to the, there are people playing around with models that are not just help keep them going, but are also helping other people as well.
Okay, well, I think with that we should probably wrap up. We've been talking for a while.
Yeah.
So for our listeners, please connect with us. If you have email feedback, send it to podcast@libralounge.org. You can follow us on the Fediverse at LibraLounge, at floss.social. You can join our IRC channel. It's a hash LibraLounge on Freenode. Hopefully Chris is having a good time on their vacation, and we'll be back soon with more of our regular techie stuff. But I think this was a nice break, and I know we're going to do more stuff around gaming as Chris evolves. So I hope you guys all stay tuned for that, and we'll see you next time. Thanks a lot, Sean.
You're very welcome. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, everybody.
Bye-bye. LibraLounge is hosted by Christopher Lemmer-Weber and Sergio Klasky. The show is produced and edited by Sergio Klasky. You can learn more and subscribe at LibraLounge.org. This podcast is released under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 4.0 International License. The intro music is Bossa Nova by Jock, released under the CC0 license. Today's outro music is Epic Theme No. 1 by Stephen O'Brien, and it's released under the Creative Commons Attribution 3.0 Unported License. Thanks for lounging with us.